This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 7, Episode 31, Three Men and a Dog. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we have three cricket coaches and one very special dog joining us on the show to talk about cricket. We talk about how you work out what a good performance is. When you say we should have scored 30 more runs there, how do you know that's right? Well, we talk about it on this week's show. And we also answer questions, one about taking singles and one about bowling leg spin. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to better cricket, and whether you're playing it or coaching it, we're here to help you. We are three men and a dog, literally. That old phrase that people used to say about how many people watch county cricket. But here it's literally true because I'm David Hinchliffe. I look after things. And joining me on the line are two very fine cricket coaches and one very fine dog.
She'll be very pleased to hear that.
And that voice you hear is Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School and pet owner, Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris.
How are you? Okay?
Very good, thanks. Yeah. You're enjoying a stroll in the sunshine. I can hear that. It's not Foley, it's definitely you.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, we're being authentic. We're going for a little stroll in the parks.
That's your title,
Torsen's
then, anyway.
We've got a load of lovely parks that run sort of through it and then out into the countryside. So we take advantage of it as much as we can on days like these.
Titles anymore. Or I don't. Maybe it's a private session after I've gone.
Secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. I was thinking this week about one of those classic things that you hear in cricket all the time, which is especially when a team lose. You always hear them say, well, we could have got 30 more today. We were just 30 short of what was a good total. And I was thinking to myself, that's interesting. Is there any way to... Is that just one of the things that people say to sort of, you know, make up for the fact that they lost the game? Or is it something that you can think about and you can review and say to yourself, you know, we scored 170, the opposition got it in the last over... Seven down. How can we assess whether we were short of a few runs there or not? Or is it just one of those things you have to sort of put your finger in the air and go, you know, based on experience, here's what I think we could have done, but we didn't quite get there today?
Well, I think the question that comes out, or the word actually, which forms a question that comes out is how, you know, how, if we had that opportunity again, if we could get in the old TARDIS and go back in time or meet Marty McFly and get in a DeLorean, what would we do? You know, how would we go about it differently? What have we learnt from today that could inform us the next time that we play in those similar conditions, or if it's on your home ground, you know, the next time that you play there? So I think the question how is a fantastic question because it doesn't point fingers, the question how. Whereas sometimes when we get into review, we can get into a point where people start going, well, if it had done this and it had done that. Whereas if you say a how, it generally goes across the board and people take ownership collectively on how they're going to go about it next time round.
Ladies, is that something you hear coming up quite a lot, that phrase, you know, we were 30 runs short today, or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, it does. It's something that's almost, it's almost a bit of a throwaway comment as well sometimes, where people will point out that they could have had another 25 or 30 or 40 or whatever it might be. The numbers almost irrelevant for us for the conversation today, but it's then left a lot, isn't it? And what's done about it? And sometimes people will say, as Gareth said, you can sometimes point the finger and say, well, you could have been a bit more aggressive here, or maybe you should have played these shots better at this stage, or whatever it might be. But actually, it's probably goes a bit deeper than that, and it's, well, at what stage should I know that I should be playing more shots, or what stage should I know that this is the target we're going for, and actually there is there more team communication we can have? How effectively do we get information on and off the field while people are batting? How quickly can we reassure those guys in the middle that we feel that they can go and be really positive? And the sooner we have something that the whole team buys into, people feel a little bit more supported in taking on those challenges. And sometimes you can be out in the middle and you can be thinking, I need to play a few more shots, but what happens if I get out? But if you've got that support, that if you get out, the team has said, this is what we need you to do and this is the way we want to approach it, then suddenly you've got a little bit more freedom to go and express yourself in the way you want to and hopefully go and get to that target. So communication off the field to on the field and vice versa as much as possible, and just a team investment in what you're trying to achieve and the target you're trying to get, and spreading, it's almost, I don't want to say spreading the blame, because it's not the blame that's the issue, but it's spreading out that decision-making process rather than lumping it on one person.
I think the important thing to remember about cricket is the game repeats, doesn't it? You know, we'll be 30 for 3 one week and there'll be another stage, whether it be in this season or whether it be in another season, we'll be in exactly the same position. And the teams that don't ask the questions of how and don't learn from their previous experience and their previous failings often repeat 30 to 3, turning into 70 for 9, turning into not getting enough and losing the game. But the ones that ask that question, then they might want to choose one focus, which is really important for them to do, whether it's running between the wickets, whether it's sideline support for the guys out in the middle, whatever the case may be. You know, I'm not going to tell you what your focus is going to be, but the bottom line is that you will be faced with 30 to 3. You will be faced with 150 for 5 or whatever the case may be. Those things come up again and again. And generally what we see is the teams that, you know, review or have just good informal chats with good open-ended questions are the ones that will find themselves coming out of that hole rather than just repeating, losing or getting themselves into even more of a hole.
And do you think there's value in putting numbers on it, in saying that word 30 more runs, or even, you know, this on this pitch we should score 200, or do you think that's too limiting to start putting specific numbers down, even in review?
I think it's quite difficult to get from point one to the kind of finishing point. So we probably have different objectives for different moments in a game. So can we try and, if we've got a power play, can we use the power play in this way? Then there are certain outcomes you could have if things have gone, very, very simply, things have gone well or things haven't gone well. If things go well, can we then look to play in this way? If things haven't gone well, can we use the middle overs in a different way? So almost... almost kind of a diagram of different decisions can be laid out. It doesn't have to be physically drawn out, but just so you know that if things turn well or poorly, you've got an idea of how they can develop as you're going along. So I think having a specific end number is quite difficult, but focusing on how you want to play in different situations, again, the process a little bit more, is probably going to get you more to that end number rather than just saying, right, we need 220, go and find it. Again, some people may have the skills to go and do that, but I think most people would probably like it to be broken down a little bit more to give themselves a little bit more clarity if they could. That probably comes down to player roles, doesn't it? Something that Northants have talked about quite a lot is clarity of roles and clarity of everyone's position in the side and what's been asked of them, how they contribute to a 2020 game. And that's obviously worked particularly well for them, despite not being on paper the most glamorous or the most skillful or the fittest. But they know what their jobs are and they do them really well.
Well, they certainly did that, didn't they? I mean, you don't get to consistent finals days. You don't win 2 trophies out of 4 in that competition without having real good role clarity, which is often supported by an understanding of particularly how your home games go. I mean, that's the crucial thing, getting out of your group, getting your home games right. And then when you get into the latter stages of any competitions with finals days and whatever, it's about adapting to what's thrown at you on the day. But that role clarity is crucial. And, you know, it contributed to them scoring more runs in lots of games than anybody else. They were brilliant at chasing, and I think the ability for them to just keep going and playing their game with that backing that Sam talked about earlier from the sidelines enables people to get beyond what is a normal good score or chase down what is perceived being a really, really tough target. And they did it particularly well. And I think it's easier in the shorter formats to do that. I think once the game gets more open, there's more deliveries, there's more different nuances and things that can come into a game of cricket. It's less easy to be sort of more numbersy based, and roles are, you're probably a little bit more flexible, but certainly in shorter formats you can do that.
I think they compare quite well to the I want to say the old Hampshire side. It's not that long ago now, but the Hampshire side, where again there was a lot of clarity of roles. They were extremely successful in one day and 2020 cricket in particular. They didn't necessarily have the big international superstars throughout the side, but they had lots of guys who were very effective at what they did. And you'd have the likes of Briggsy bowling his very restrictive left arm spin, and Dimi Mascarenhas beating the bat all ends up and being a 65, 75 miles an hour, one of the most frustrating and most difficult bowlers to play in the country. And people knew what their role was, and they didn't have anyone bowling at 95 miles an hour necessarily, and they didn't have lots of these world beaters, but they had 11 or 12 guys who were pretty good at their jobs and knew what their jobs were.
Okay, let's wrap up this section with a yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more the team want to say. I've got the questions, so let's fire away. First question, culture precedes performance.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question, being the best means taking risks.
Yes. Yes.
Third question, coaching is about turning on the light bulbs in your players.
Yes.
Yes.
Now let's move on to the mailbag. Got a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show, or maybe readers to the Pitchfishing Academy website. We don't discriminate here. And we do our best to answer those questions, and then we pick one of the questions as the best question of the week, and that wins a prize. Every week there's a prize, and it's an online coaching course from Pitchfishing Academy at pitchfishing.com. You can send your questions in to us by emailing coach@pitchfishing.com or getting us through social media, and we'll tell you about that towards the end of the show. But for now, we've got a question for Robin, or question from Robin, I should say. It's pretty straightforward, but I think it's one of those things which is quite hard to set up training for, quite hard to work on, so definitely worth discussing. Robin says, can you give me tips or drills for taking singles?
Yeah, well, certainly in terms of drills, you're probably looking more along the lines of execution. So being able to execute the ball going into certain areas, which enable you to get a single. But I think more importantly than that, it's the decision making, the collective decision making, because singles are obviously a combination of two people. And if you get that stuff starting to work well, then you can do some heady things. So going back to your question earlier about 170, David, it's rarely is 170 going to be a score that you're going to go well with, as you found out the other day, or a team found out the other day. But to get 190, to get 200 could have been just purely down to two people working together, or a combination of different two people to steal five runs between each partnership, or whatever the case may be, and that's a collective. But let's go back to the first. But execution, well, it depends who you're playing against, whether it's spin or whether it's pace. But some basic drills, and around the clock drill that we tend to see used within spin play is a really good one. And basically, you think about a clock face. You're standing at the middle of it as the batter. The ball comes in, and you're trying to hit the different numbers around the clock face, and you can go from maybe 1 to 12, or you can get the person that's bowling or throwing or putting the ball in the machine, whatever the case may be, to call out a number that you've got to hit. And then you get used to getting your body the right side of a ball. You get used to using your hands and your wrists to being able to manoeuvre the ball into play. And it's a really good one. It's dead old-fashioned. I think my first ever coaching course that I went on back in 1840, somebody showed me it. But it's one that stands the test of time. There's a pun in there. So, round the clock face is a really good one. Easier to do against slower pace bowling than against quick pace bowling. But as we've seen the game develop, we see people using their body, moving themselves around a bit more in order to open up areas. So it can go across into playing fast bowling as well. So that's a really good start. The other one is keeping the ball close, and this is really relevant to fast bowlers when you're facing fast bowlers as well. Having that ability to keep the ball close, it often comes from having a slightly softer grip, particularly with the bottom hand. Somebody like Marcus Trzaskowski, who I watched yesterday, was somebody who practiced this hell of a lot. So when he was facing the bowling machine, he'd have a drill which might last for 5 minutes. When he defended, the aim, even indoors where the ball tends to ping about a little bit off the surface, that he's able to keep the ball in really close, drop it towards his feet, or make the ball bounce twice before it hits the net is another really good one. You can actually put out cones around you. So if you've got a bit of space, you're out in the middle, or you've got a wide net, maybe in the summer you're practicing, you've got a wide net that the groundsman's put up, then putting in those cones around you, put a circumference, and basically what you're looking to do is to keep the ball as close to you as possible, which in turn in a game of cricket is going to move the fielders as much as you possibly can, create time for you and your partner to get at the other end. But they're two really basic drills. They are so old school, it is crazy, but they've stood the test of time.
Labors, what about that's drills, that two great drills, and very well used, but always worth going over again, because not everybody knows about them. But Labors, what about the tip singles side of it? What about the when you're actually out in the middle?
Well, again, comes back to that clarity of roles or clarity of decisions bit that we've mentioned already. But in terms of the discussion between the batters, I think in terms of getting people moving and having that first step in a positive way and making sure that people trust each other, just a little bit of conversation about what you're intending to do can help again. It's great if you can execute a drop on one, or you can hit in a specific direction, and then you can call your single. But if your partner is expecting that, then everything's going to work so much better. So if you can say that, well, I'm aware that I've got an opportunity here and here and here, so if I do push the ball in that direction, be expecting me to try and steal one, then suddenly everyone's on the front foot and everyone's looking to explode out into that sprint and get down the other end. Whereas if suddenly someone drops the ball at their feet, first ball of the game, the other guy's sitting on his bat, he's not expecting it. Not only do you miss the opportunity and the skill that the guy's executed is wasted, but also you're potentially causing an issue with a run out. So I would say just as much conversation as you can about where the opportunities lie, why they lie in different areas, because you can't just say there's a gap there, I'm going to hit it there, because often, as we know, there's a gap there for a reason. It's because the bowler wants you to do something. So making sure we have real clear discussion about which opportunities are worth taking on, and if they are going to be taken on, then we're expecting it and we're ready to shoot off. Just another simple thing that we've introduced over the last year or so is more for the non-striker, but just trying to have a repetition of body position for the non-striker. So much as you would look at a wicketkeeper and their position, or a fielder or a slip, and say, right, if we've got 300 deliveries in this game, how many times can we execute a really good body position into the point of release? How many times can that non-striker execute the same thing? So we do something called a three-step shuffle, which is batting left hand, obviously, if it's right arm over, and then three side shuffles down the pitch as fast as we can as the ball's being let go, to try and get in a position to then to then go on and take that run or to get back. But the more it happens, the more runs we start to steal. And it's something that's been going on for probably just a little over a year now. And it's starting to become an automatic for the guys. And that not only inspires confidence in the guy at the batter's end, because he knows if he wants to run, the other guy's going to make it. But it's translating into numbers on the board as well, which is really good. And yes, every now and then you might find that the guy drills one down the ground, gets a bowler, gets a finger on it, and you run out. But as we've said when we've talked about this, we'll accept that if that happens twice a season, but we steal 100 runs, then an average of 50 is probably worth it.
Is it something that you, I guess it's a question for both of you, to start with you, Gareth, is it something that you actively keep an eye on, how many singles a team is picking up over the course of a season in each game?
Yeah, we do. We run a little thing on the iPhone that goes ding when we pick up a stolen run. We also have a little button that makes a different noise that if we miss one as well. And we keep a tab, particularly if we're on the ground that's got the video system on it. We keep a tab of the ball and then review it to not have a go at somebody, but to go, right, okay, you know, what would you do again? What, you know, how would you go about it? What was your communication like leading into the innings? So did you know that there were automatic singles around? And that's the thing that often the ding button gets pressed for, is when there's an automatic single. And that automatic single is where basically it's been decided that when the ball goes into that spot, we're running. And it's something I learned way back. I mean, I went watching my dad bat with a guy called Pete Buckley. They never used to call, because they'd had it all worked out that when it goes to his left, when it goes in that gap, when it hits me on the pad, that's us going. And they just used to sometimes not even look at each other and just go. And it was absolutely magnificent to watch that happening in 1983. And it's something that when I started to coach professionally, I was so surprised that there weren't many people doing it. And certainly in 2005, we ran people ragged in all forms of a game at Somerset. And the only team that got close to us was the one that Mike Hussey influenced, and that was Durham. And he came in with exactly the same idea, because when he grew up playing grade cricket in Australia, he had two or three guys in the side that he used to watch when he was scoring, just like I did, who did this, and he'd taken it all the way through his cricket.
Lavers, do you keep a track of these things?
We actually, depends on the team that would be concerned at school, but actually we will review again when we're filming matches. We'll have a number of things which are tagged throughout the game, but one of them would be an opportunity, or often a glaring error, but we call it an opportunity to get to win something extra along the way. So that'll be tagged and that'll be reviewed, and we'll look at something like that. The other thing that is very simple to do, especially in this day and age with scoring on iPhones and iPads and all that kind of stuff, is just looking visually at the scorecard. And I remember sitting down with friend of the show James Hughes, who will be listening, I'm sure, just to go through one of his early performances of his under 15 side earlier in the summer, and he'd picked out a couple of things which had led to them not scoring as many runs as they needed on the day. But one of the other things I picked out was, if we just by looking visually at the scorecard, if you looked at everyone's first six balls, I think out of the 60 or so first six balls that were in total, we'd probably picked up about 8 or 9 runs, which isn't particularly proactive or productive. And that became a big theme for him over the next few weeks. And that's, subsequently, he really got them working hard and turned the group into some that were a really, really positive and proactive group, who could get the scoreboard ticking early on and really play positive cricket from a batting and bowling point of view. But just a simple bit of looking at a scorecard. So you can do that where you've got a scorebook, you're on an app or whatever, you don't need too much. So pretty simple thing to do, just to try and review how well you're getting off the mark, or if there are periods in a game where something's happening. Obviously you don't always have that visual backup, and if you do, that makes it more useful, but it still promotes a bit of discussion and hopefully creates some kind of solution or outcome.
Next question is from Rohan, and Rohan says, Hi guys, I'm a young leg spin bowler and I'm always confused about whether to have the rough side resting on my palm or the shiny side on my palm when bowling my leg break. Which side do you recommend be rested on the palm? So I guess we could answer this in a very short shrift, but I feel like there's a discussion to be had here as well. So Lavers, what do you think?
Well, I think if we were playing cricket on daylight today and you were coming on for a bowl as a leg spinner and you had a fast bowler down the other end who was looking to do something with the ball, he would probably be asking to keep your hands away from the rough side as much as you could. So this isn't necessarily something for your own performance, but that would be something that would probably be benefiting the group a little bit, just in terms of keeping the one side dry and not letting that sweat from the palms of your hands get on the ball. So that would be an immediate thing for someone to consider. Obviously, leg spinners actually have quite different grips, don't they? And you hear Shane Warne in the many video sessions he's done with Sky Sports and various things about how you can hold the ball, and some people hold the ball a lot looser and some people hold the ball right back in the palm of their hand. So the degree of importance of that in that situation, as it refers to a fast bowler and how they're going to be able to utilise the ball later in the day, is probably going to be very depending on your own grip. Other people might want to have variations in that, again, to try and confuse what's going on with the batsman, because a lot of batsmen will work quite closely with their eyes. So it might be that you can disrupt the batsman's thought process by changing the side along the way if they're looking for changes in release and changes in grip. But I would start by thinking about not getting bullied by the big lads and looking after the ball for them.
Well, I think that's pretty comprehensive, actually, what Sam talked about. To me, it's about the intention of the team. So, you know, if for example, that leg spinner is bowling in conditions that we know people listen to the show from subcontinent, then it might be that actually the seamers are trying to get the ball to reverse. And if they're trying to get the ball to reverse, then it's probably a pretty good idea at some point not to get any moisture on the ball, whether it be on either side. I mean, the dry side would be a killer for it. But the shiny side sometimes, particularly if you're just trying to dome the ball, i.e. that sort of cone on the top of the ball, trying to keep that shiny and the rest of it, you're not so fussed about it. As long as it's smooth on one side and rough on the other, you're not fussed about whether it's shiny or not. You know, just try and keep your hands, as Sam said, off the ball as much as possible. But equally, in different conditions, the shiny side going into the palm, you can actually use some of that to get the ball to buff. So it's very individual to the circumstances that you play. And I think Sam's last point was really relevant. And the relevance of that is there's no point in bowling like a drain just because you're trying to look after the ball. You know, your job actually is to get the ball down the other end, ask questions of the batter and to do your job. And if you're not doing your job, you'll soon find that there'll be a number of fingers being pointed at you. And your defence of, well, I'm trying to look after the ball for the other bloke, probably won't save you. So I'm with Sam on that last point. But, you know, check out what everybody's looking to do with the ball. Check out what the intention is, how we're looking to try and get wickets, what the role of a seamer is going to be, and then try and factor that in. But never get away from the fact that you're there to deliver your skill.
The thing I'd add into it as well is people are usually quite consistent in the way they land the ball, and some people will ideally land the ball on the seam, as you'd imagine, and that's going to promote the spin. Some people, and this is probably more relevant to finger spinners, but don't necessarily get over the top of the ball, and subsequently there'll be a bit of almost a backward tilt on the ball where you're not going to land quite on the seam, and even though there might be good sideways and forwards revolutions on it, it can be sitting back a little bit, and that means the ball's going to land on the side that you're palming effectively. So if you are in that position where you're not actually getting the ball to onto a plane where it's landing on the seam, it's consistently landing on one side, you may find that your release is getting the ball landing on the side that your palm is on. And I'm thinking as a finger spinner at the moment, so this isn't necessarily relevant to this question, but within the general discussion, might be that as a finger spinner, you might promote more roughness on that side if you do that. Not many finger spinners would necessarily land the ball on the other side, because that would be very, very difficult to get their wrist in that position to do so. But I think having Gareth's a really good point from Gareth is having an awareness of how you fit into what the team is trying to achieve. And if it's all down to you and it's a day four, day five pitch or whatever, and the other guys are almost redundant and there's no reverse swing or anything going on, then you can almost do what you want as long as you're doing your job really well. But how can you also impact positively on the rest of the group? There might be an opportunity there as well.
It comes back to that message you were talking about earlier, doesn't it? About communicating and agreeing and discussing things and making sure that the people who are involved in that, you know, that idea of looking after the ball, which is something by itself that is often overlooked. You know, everyone's agreeing to do the thing that is going to get the best performance out of the team.
I've been in team discussions after the game, and the fast bowler has said after a game, well, look, you didn't look after the ball and you bowled 10 overs from one end and you bowled all right, but you didn't look after the ball, and I've bowled the other end, or I've come back after and you've given me a ball that's in no state to be used. But again, too little too late, isn't it? And that's not, yes, the spinner is at fault potentially for not looking after it as well as he could, but in terms of communicating your kind of what you would like the spinner to do and making sure that the timing of that communication is good, then ultimately the fast bowler's not in, the fast bowler's probably a little bit in the wrong as well. So making sure that clarity is coming out throughout. People know what's expected of them. Yes, we want you to bowl, but we also want you to look after this with the ball. We also want you to do X, Y, and Z. Yeah, the more people communicate, the more they know where they stand, and the better the chance we've got of achieving something.
Yeah, blaming people for things is very rarely an effective strategy to changing behaviour, is it? So, you know, this, if you want to have an outcome that suits you, then probably blame is one of the lowest things on the list of strategies you can take to help influence someone's behaviour, right?
Yeah, and it's really simply changed. It's like, if you say, look, you've not looked after the ball, and then because of that, I couldn't get any swing or whatever, and subsequently we've lost. And that's just direct blame, isn't it? But if you say, from a different angle, like, is there any way you could look after the ball better to give me a better opportunity next time, so you can have a positive impact on the team even when you're not bowling? Is you're giving someone a chance to add something to their game, and you're giving someone an opportunity to have a bigger contribution to the side and the result. You're dangling a carrot rather than cracking a whip, aren't you?
Yep. Yeah, and if you're the bowler who gets that ball to swing away from the bat and the batsman nicks off, you give the spinner who's been looking after the ball for the last 20 overs a little wink.
Yeah, straight away you're going to be over and high-fiving it. Everyone's going to be all over him, and it's going to be like he's got another wicket. He's going to want it in his stats at the end of the season, isn't he?
I know a couple of spinners who might even claim it.
I'd have claimed it if I'd have got a ball.
And that is the end of the show for another week. We are about to head off, but before we do that, we are going to do the paperwork. That means deciding on the winner of this week's competition. The two questions available to win the prize of the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com are Robin's question about taking singles and Rohan's question about which side to have the shiny side of the ball when you're bowling spin. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Robin's, actually. Some proper old school stuff talked about there. But, you know, as with many things in this game, even this innovative world in which we live in now, there's some really good basics and good basic drills. And hopefully those two and a bit of advice along the way have helped you there, mate.
Fantastic. Congratulations to you. And then if someone was thinking about sending in their own question, maybe winning the prize, certainly getting answered on the show, how could they get in touch with us, Gareth?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's correct. You can also find us on Facebook. Facebook.com/Pitch Vision Academy is where we are there. and our Twitter is at pitchvisionacad. You can listen to the show every week. If you want to do that, you can just go to your favourite podcast app on your phone or your tablet or your computer. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy and click or tap on the subscribe button. It's free and it comes out every week. If you want to get all the old show notes or stream the show or get more details on cricket coaching and playing, you can head over to pitchvision.com/academy online and click on the podcast link for all the details there. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.